Yet that far. At first he looked a little awestruck, like he couldn't quite believe it. Then he gave a sad little smile.
Yo mama better watch his back, he said.
The auditions were held in San Francisco. Dad had some big conference at the school that week and couldn't get away, and Mom had just started a new job at the travel agency, so Gran volunteered to accompany me. We'll make a girl's weekend of it. Take high tea at the Fairmont. Go window shopping in Union Square. Ride the ferry to Alcatraz. We'll be tourists. But a week before we were due to leave, Gran tripped over a tree root and sprained her ankle. She had to wear one of those clunky boots and wasn't supposed to walk. Minor panic ensued. I said I could just go by myself, drive or take the train and come right back. It was Gramps who insisted on taking me. We drove down together in his pickup truck. We didn't talk much, which was fine by me because I was so nervous. I kept fingering the popsicle stick good luck talisman Teddy had presented me with before we left. "Break an arm," he'd told me. Gramps and I listened to classical music and farm reports on the radio when we could pick up a station. Otherwise, we sat in silence. But it was such a calming silence. It made me relax and feel closer to him than any heart-to-heart would have. Gran had booked us in a really frilly inn, and it was funny to see Gramps in his work boots and plaid flannel amid all the lacy doilies and potpourri, but he took it all in stride. The audition was grueling. I had to play five pieces, a Shostakovich concerto, two Bach suites, all Tchaikovsky's Pezzo Capriccioso, which was next to impossible, and a movement from Ennio Morricone's The Mission, a fun but risky choice because Yo-Yo Ma had covered this and everyone would compare. I walked out with my legs wobbly and my underarms wet with sweat. But my endorphins were surging, and that, combined with a huge sense of relief, left me totally giddy. "Shall we see the town?" Gramps asked, his lips twitching into a smile. "Definitely." We did all the things Gran had promised we would do. Gramps took me to high tea and shopping, although for dinner, we skipped out on the reservations Gran had made at some fancy place on Fisherman's Wharf and instead wandered into Chinatown, looking for the restaurant with the longest line of people waiting outside, and ate there. When we got back home, Gramps dropped me off and enveloped me in a hug. Normally he was a handshaker, maybe a back patter on really special occasions. His hug was strong and tight, and I knew it was his way of telling me that he'd had a wonderful time. "Me too, Gramps," I whispered. 3:47 p.m. They just moved me out of the recovery room into the Trauma Intensive Care Unit, or ICU. It's a horseshoe-shaped room with about a dozen beds and a cadre of nurses who constantly bustle around, reading the computer printouts that churn out from the feet of our beds recording our vital signs. In the middle of the room are more computers and a big desk where another nurse sits. I have two nurses who check in on me, along with the endless round of doctors. One is a taciturn, doughy man with blonde hair and a mustache, who I don't much like, and the other is a woman with skin so black it's blue and a lilt in her voice. She calls me sweetheart and perpetually straightens the blankets around me, even though it's not like I'm kicking them off. There are so many tubes attached to me that I cannot count them all. One down my throat, breathing for me. One down my nose, keeping my stomach empty. One in my vein, hydrating me. One in my bladder, peeing for me. Several on my chest, recording my heartbeat. Another on my finger, recording my pulse. The ventilator that's doing my breathing has a soothing rhythm, like a metronome. In, out. In, out. No one, aside from the doctors and nurses and a social worker, has been in to see me. It's the social worker who speaks to Gran and Gramps in hushed, sympathetic tones. She tells them that I am in grave condition. I'm not entirely sure what that means, grave. On TV, patients are always critical or stable. Grave sounds bad. Grave is where you go when things don't work out here. "I wish there was something we could do," Gran says. "I feel so useless just waiting."
I'll see if I can get you in to see her in a little while, the social worker says. She has frizzy gray hair and a coffee stain on her blouse. Her face is kind. She's still sedated from the surgery, and she's on a ventilator to help her breathe while her body heals from the trauma, but it can be helpful even for patients in a comatose state to hear from their loved ones. Gramps grunts in reply. Do you have any people you can call? The social worker asks. Relatives who might like to be here with you. I understand this must be quite a trial for you, but the stronger you can be, the more it will help Mia. I startle when I hear the social worker say my name. It's a jarring reminder that it's me they're talking about. Gran tells her about the various people who are en route right now. Aunts, uncles. I don't hear any mention of Adam. Adam is the one I really want to see. I wish I knew where he was so I could try to go there. I have no idea how he's going to find out about me. Gran and Gramps don't have his phone number. They don't carry cell phones, so he can't call them. And I don't know how he'd even know to call them. The people who would normally pass along pertinent information that something has happened to me are in no position to do that. I stand over the bleeping, tubed, lifeless form that is me. My skin is gray. My eyes are taped shut. I wish someone would take the tape off. It looks like it itches. The nice nurse bustles over. Her scrubs have lollipops on them, even though this isn't a pediatric unit. How's it going, sweetheart? She asks me, as if we just bumped into each other in the grocery store. It didn't start out so smoothly with Adam and me. I think I had this notion that love conquers all, and by the time he dropped me off from the Yo-Yo Ma concert, I think we were both aware that we were falling in love. I thought that getting to this part was the challenge. In books and movies, the story always ends when the two people finally have their romantic kiss. The happily ever after part is just assumed. It didn't quite work that way for us. It turned out that coming from such far corners of the social universe had its downsides. We continued to see each other in the music wing, but these interactions remained platonic, as if neither one of us wanted to mess with a good thing. But whenever we met at other places in the school, when we sat together in the cafeteria or studied side by side on the quad on a sunny day, something was off. We were uncomfortable. Conversation was stilted. One of us would say something and the other would start to say something else at the same time. You go, I'd say. No, you go, Adam would say. The politeness was painful. I wanted to push through it, to return to the glow of the night of the concert, but I was unsure of how to get back there. Adam invited me to see his band play. This was even worse than school. If I felt like a fish out of water in my family, I felt like a fish on Mars in Adam's circle. He was always surrounded by funky, lively people, by cute girls with dyed hair and piercings, by aloof guys who perked up when Adam rock-talked with them. I couldn't do the groupie thing, and I didn't know how to rock-talk at all. It was a language I should have understood, being both a musician and Dad's daughter, but I didn't. It was like how Mandarin speakers can sort of understand Cantonese, but not really, even though non-Chinese people assume all Chinese can communicate with one another, even though Mandarin and Cantonese are actually different. I dreaded going to shows with Adam. It wasn't that I was jealous or that I wasn't into his kind of music. I loved to watch him play. When he was on stage, it was like the guitar was a fifth limb, a natural extension of his body. And when he came off stage afterward, he would be sweaty, but it was such a clean sweat that part of me was tempted to lick the side of his face like it was a lollipop. I didn't, though. Once the fans would descend, I'd skitter off to the sidelines. Adam would try to draw me back, to wrap an arm around my waist, but I'd disentangle myself and head back to the shadows. "Don't you like me anymore?" Adam chided me after one show. He was kidding, but I could hear the hurt behind the offhand question. "I don't know if I should keep coming to your shows," I said. "Why not?" he asked. This time he didn't try to disguise the hurt. "I feel like I keep you from basking in it all. I don't want you to have to worry about me." Adam said that he didn't mind worrying about me, but I could tell that part of him did. We probably would have broken up in those early weeks were it not for my house. At my house, with my family, we found a common ground. After we'd been together for a month, I took Adam home with me for his first family dinner with us. He sat in the kitchen with Dad, rock-talking. I observed, and I still didn't understand half of it, but unlike at the shows, I didn't feel left out. "Do you play basketball?" Dad asked. When it came to observing sports, Dad was a baseball fanatic. But when it came to playing, he loved to shoot hoops.
"Sure,"
Adam said. "I mean, I'm not very good."
"You don't need to be good. You just need to be committed. Want to play a quick game? You already have your basketball shoes on,"
Dad said, looking at Adam's Converse high tops. Then he turned to me.
"You mind?"
"Not at all," I said, smiling. "I can practice while you play." They went out to the courts behind the nearby elementary school. They returned 45 minutes later. Adam was covered with a sheen of sweat and looking a little dazed.
"What happened?" I asked. "Did the old man whoop you?"
Adam shook his head and nodded at the same time.
"Well, yes, but it's not that. I got stung by a bee on my palm while we were playing. Your dad grabbed my hand and sucked the venom out."
I nodded. This was a trick he'd learned from Gran, and unlike with rattlesnakes, it actually worked on bee stings. You got the stinger and the venom out, so you were left with only a little itch. Adam broke into an embarrassed smile. He leaned in and whispered into my ear, "I think I'm a little wigged out that I've been more intimate with your dad than I have with you." I laughed at that, but it was sort of true. In the few weeks we'd been together, we hadn't done much more than kiss. It wasn't that I was a prude. I was a virgin, but I certainly wasn't devoted to staying that way. And Adam certainly wasn't a virgin. It was more that our kissing had suffered from the same painful politeness as our conversations. "Maybe we should remedy that," I murmured. Adam raised his eyebrows as if asking me a question. I blushed in response. All through dinner, we grinned at each other as we listened to Teddy, who was chattering about the dinosaur bones he'd apparently dug up in the back garden that afternoon. Dad had made his famous salt roast, which was my favorite dish, but I had no appetite. I pushed the food around my plate, hoping no one would notice. All the while, this little buzz was building inside me. I thought of the tuning fork I used to adjust my cello. Hitting it sets off vibrations in the note of A, vibrations that keep growing and growing until the harmonic pitch fills up the room. That's what Adam's grin was doing to me during dinner. After the meal, Adam took a quick peek at Teddy's fossil finds, and then we went upstairs to my room and closed the door. Kim is not allowed to be alone in her house with boys, not that the opportunity ever came up. My parents had never mentioned any rules on this issue, but I had a feeling that they knew what was happening with Adam and me, and even though Dad liked to play it all father knows best, in reality, he and Mom were suckers when it came to love. Adam lay down on my bed, stretching his arms above his head. His whole face was grinning, eyes, nose, mouth. "Play me," he said.
"What?"
"I want you to play me like a cello." I started to protest that this made no sense, but then I realized it made perfect sense. I went to my closet and grabbed one of my spare bows. "Take off your shirt," I said, my voice quavering. Adam did. As thin as he was surprisingly built. I could have spent 20 minutes staring at the contours and valleys of his chest, but he wanted me closer. I wanted me closer. I sat down next to him on the bed so his long body was stretched out in front of me. The bow trembled as I placed it on the bed. I reached with my left hand and caressed Adam's head as if it were the scroll of my cello. He smiled again and closed his eyes. I relaxed a little. I fiddled with his ears as though they were the string pegs, and then I playfully tickled him as he laughed softly. I placed two fingers on his Adam's apple. Then, taking a deep breath for courage, I plunged into his chest. I ran my hands up and down the length of his torso, focusing on the sinews in his muscles, assigning each one a string, A, G, C, D. I traced them down, one at a time, with the tip of my fingers. Adam got quiet then, as if he were concentrating on something. I reached for the bow and brushed it across his hips, where I imagined the bridge of the cello would be. I played lightly at first, and then with more force and speed, as the song now playing in my head increased in intensity. Adam lay perfectly still, little groans escaping from his lips. I looked at the bow, looked at my hands, looked at Adam's face, and felt this surge of love, lust, and an unfamiliar feeling of power. I had never known that I could make someone feel this way. When I finished, he stood up and kissed me long and deep. "My turn," he said. He pulled me to my feet and started by slipping the sweater over my head and edging down my jeans. Then he sat down on the bed and laid me across his lap. At first, Adam did nothing except hold me. I closed my eyes and tried to feel his eyes on my body, seeing me as no one else ever had. Then he began to play. He strummed chords across the top of my chest, which tickled and made me laugh. He gently brushed his hands, moving farther down. I stopped giggling. The tuning fork intensified, its vibrations growing every time Adam touched me somewhere new. After a while, he switched to more of a Spanish-style, finger-picking type of playing. He used the top of my body as the fretboard, caressing my hair, my face, my neck. He plucked at my chest and my belly, but I could feel him in places his hands were nowhere near. As he played on, the energy magnified, the tuning fork going crazy now, firing off vibrations all over, until my entire body was humming, until I was left breathless. And when I felt like I could not take it one more minute, the swirl of sensations hit a dizzying crescendo, sending every nerve ending in my body on high alert. I opened my eyes, savoring the warm calm that was sweeping over me. I started to laugh. Adam did, too. We kissed for a while longer until it was time for him to go home. As I walked him out to his car, I wanted to tell him that I loved him, but it seemed like such a cliche after what we'd just done. So I waited and told him the next day. "That's a relief. I thought you might just be using me for sex," he joked, smiling. After that, we still had our problems, but being overly polite with each other wasn't one of them. 4:39 p.m. I have quite the crowd now. Gran and Gramps, Uncle Greg, Aunt Diane, Aunt Kate, my cousins Heather and John and David. Dad is one of five kids, so there are still lots more relatives out there. Nobody is talking about Teddy, which leads me to believe that he's not here. He's probably still at the other hospital, being taken care of by Willow. The relatives gather in the hospital waiting room, not the little one on the surgical floor where Gran and Gramps were during my operation, but a larger one on the hospital's main floor that is tastefully decorated in shades of mauve and has comfy chairs and sofas and magazines that are almost current. Everyone still talks in hushed tones, as if being respectful of the other people waiting, even though it's only my family in the waiting room. It's all so serious, so ominous. I go back into the hallway to get a break. I'm so happy when Kim arrives, happy to see the familiar sight of her long black hair in a single braid. She wears the braid every day, and always, by lunchtime, the curls and ringlets of her thick mane have managed to escape in rebellious little tendrils. But she refuses to surrender to that hair of hers, and every morning it goes back into the braid. Kim's mother is with her. She doesn't let Kim drive long distances, and I guess that after what's happened, there's no way she'd make an exception today. Mrs. Shine is red-faced and blotchy, like she's been crying or is about to cry.
I know this because I have seen her cry many times. She's very emotional. Drama queen, is how Kim puts it. It's the Jewish mother gene. She can't help it. I suppose I'll be like that one day, too, Kim concedes. Kim is so the opposite of that, so droll and funny in a low-key way that she's always having to say just kidding to people who don't get her sarcastic sense of humor, that I cannot imagine her ever being like her mother. Then again, I don't have much basis for comparison. There are not a lot of Jewish mothers in our town, or that many Jewish kids at our school. And the kids who are Jewish are usually only half, so all it means is that they have a menorah alongside their Christmas trees. But Kim is really Jewish. Sometimes I have Friday night dinner with her family when they light candles, eat braided bread, and drink wine. The only time I can imagine neurotic Mrs. Shine allowing Kim to drink. Kim's expected to only date Jewish guys, which means she doesn't date. She jokes that this is the reason her family moved here, when in fact it was because her father was hired to run a computer chip plant. When she was 13, she had a bat mitzvah at a temple in Portland, and during the candlelighting ceremony at the reception, I got called up to light one. Every summer she goes to Jewish sleepaway camp in New Jersey. It's called Camp Torah Habanim, but Kim calls it Torah Whore, because all the kids do all summer is hook up. Just like band camp, she joked, though my summer conservatory program is nothing like American Pie. Right now I can see Kim is annoyed. She's walking fast, keeping a good 10 feet between her and her mother as they march down the halls. Suddenly her shoulders go up like a cat that's just spied a dog. She swerves to face her mother. Stop it, Kim demands. If I'm not crying, there's no fucking way you're allowed to. Kim never curses, so this shocks me. But, Mrs. Shine protests, how can you be so, sob, so calm when... Cut it out, Kim interjects. Mia is still here, so I'm not losing it. And if I don't lose it, you don't get to. Kim stalks off in the direction of the waiting room, her mother following limply behind. When they reach the waiting room and see my assembled family, Mrs. Shine starts sniffling. Kim doesn't curse this time, but her ears go pink, which is how I know she's still furious. Mother, I am going to leave you here. I'm taking a walk. I'll be back later. I follow her back out into the corridor. She wanders around the main lobby, loops around the gift shop, visits the cafeteria. She looks at the hospital directory. I think I know where she's headed before she does. There's a small chapel in the basement. It's hushed in there, a library kind of quiet. There are plush chairs, like the kind you find at a movie theater, and a muted soundtrack playing some New Agey type music. Kim slumps back in one of the chairs. She takes off her coat, the one that is black and velvet, and that I have coveted since she bought it at some mall in New Jersey on a trip to visit her grandparents. I love Oregon, she says with a hiccup attempt at a laugh. I can tell by her sarcastic tone that it's me she's talking to, not God. This is the hospital's idea of non-denominational. She points around the chapel. There's a crucifix mounted on the wall, a flag of a cross draped over the lectern, and a few paintings of the Madonna and child hanging in the back. We have a token Star of David, she says, gesturing to the 6-pointed star on the wall. But what about the Muslims? No prayer rugs or symbol to show which way is east toward Mecca? And what about the Buddhists? Couldn't they spring for a gong? I mean, there are probably more Buddhists than Jews in Portland anyway. I sit down in a chair beside her. It feels so natural the way that Kim is talking to me like she always does. Other than the paramedic who told me to hang in there, and the nurse who keeps asking me how I'm doing, no one has talked to me since the accident. They talk about me. I've never actually seen Kim pray. I mean, she prayed at her bat mitzvah, and she does the blessings at Shabbat dinner, but that is because she has to. Mostly she makes light of her religion. But after she talks to me for a while, she closes her eyes and moves her lips and murmurs things in a language I don't understand. She opens her eyes and wipes her hands together as if to say, "Enough of that." Then she reconsiders and adds a final appeal. "Please don't die.
I can understand why you'd want to, but think about this. If you die, there's going to be one of those cheesy Princess Diana memorials at school, where everyone puts flowers and candles and notes next to your locker. She wipes away a renegade tear with the back of her hand. I know you'd hate that kind of thing. Maybe it was because we were too alike. As soon as Kim showed up on the scene, everyone assumed we'd be best friends just because we were both dark, quiet, studious, and, at least outwardly, serious. The thing was, neither one of us was a particularly great student, straight B averages all around, or, for that matter, all that serious. We were serious about certain things, music in my case, art and photography in hers, and in the simplified world of middle school, that was enough to set us apart as separated twins of some sort. Immediately, we got shoved together for everything. On Kim's third day of school, she was the only person to volunteer to be a team captain during a soccer match in PE, which I thought was beyond suck-uppy of her. As she put on her red jersey, the coach scanned the class to pick Team B's captain, his eyes settling on me, even though I was one of the least athletic girls. As I shuffled over to put on my jersey, I brushed past Kim, mumbling, "Thanks a lot." The following week, our English teacher paired us together for a joint oral discussion on To Kill a Mockingbird. We sat across from each other in stony silence for about 10 minutes. Finally, I said, "I guess we should talk about racism in the Old South or something." Kim ever so slightly rolled her eyes, which made me want to throw a dictionary at her. I was caught off guard by how intensely I already hated her. "I read this book at my old school," she said. "The racism thing is kind of obvious. I think the bigger thing is people's goodness. Are they naturally good and turned bad by stuff like racism, or are they naturally bad and need to work hard not to be?" "Whatever," I said. "It's a stupid book." I didn't know why I'd said that, because I'd actually loved the book and had talked to Dad about it. He was using it for his student teaching. I hated Kim even more for making me betray a book I loved. "Fine, we'll do your idea then," Kim said, and when we got a B-, she seemed to gloat about our mediocre grade. After that, we just didn't talk. That didn't stop teachers from pairing us together or everyone in the school from assuming that we were friends. The more that happened, the more we resented it, and each other. The more the world shoved us together, the more we shoved back, and against each other. We tried to pretend the other didn't exist, even though the existence of our nemesis kept us both occupied for hours. I felt compelled to give myself reasons why I hated Kim. She was a goody-two-shoes. She was annoying. She was a show-off. Later, I found out that she did the same thing about me, though her major complaint was that she thought I was a bitch. And one day, she even wrote it to me. In English class, someone flung a folded-up square of notebook paper onto the floor next to my right foot. I picked it up and opened it. It read, "Bitch." Nobody had ever called me that before, and though I was automatically furious, deep down I was also flattered that I had elicited enough emotion to be worthy of the name. People called Mom that a lot. Probably because she had a hard time holding her tongue and could be brutally blunt when she disagreed with you. She'd explode like a thunderstorm and then be fine again. Anyhow, she didn't care that people called her a bitch. "It's just another word for feminist," she told me with pride. Even Dad called her that sometimes, but always in a jokey, complimentary way. Never during a fight. He knew better. I looked up from my grammar book. There was only one person who would have sent this note to me, but I still scarcely believed it. I peered at the class. Everyone had their faces in their books. Except for Kim. Her ears were so red that it made the little sideburn-like tendrils of dark hair look like they were also blushing. She was glaring at me. I might have been 11 years old and a little socially immature, but I recognized a gauntlet being thrown down when I saw it, and I had no choice but to take it up. When we got older, we liked to joke that we were so glad we had that fist fight. Not only did it cement our friendship, but it also provided us our first, and likely only, opportunity for a good brawl. When else were two girls like us going to come to blows? I wrestled on the ground with Teddy, and sometimes I pinched him, but a fist fight? He was just a baby. And even if he were older, Teddy was like half kid brother and half my own kid. I'd been babysitting him since he was a few weeks old. I could never hurt him like that. And Kim, an only child, didn't have any siblings to sock. Maybe at camp she could have gotten into a scuffle, but the consequences would have been dire. Hours-long conflict resolution seminars with the counselors and the rabbi. My people know how to fight with the best of them, but with words. With lots and lots of words, she told me once. But that fall day, we fought with fists. After the last bell, without a word, we followed each other out to the playground, dropped our backpacks on the ground, which was wet from the day's steady drizzle. She charged me like a bull, knocking the wind out of me. I punched her on the side of the head, fist closed like men do. A crowd of kids gathered around to witness the spectacle. Fighting was novelty enough at our school. Girl fighting was extra special, and good girls going at it was like hitting the trifecta. By the time the teachers separated us, half of the sixth grade was watching us. In fact, it was the ring of students loitering that alerted the playground monitors that something was up. The fight was a tie, I suppose. I had a split lip and a bruised wrist, the latter inflicted upon myself when my swing at Kim's shoulder missed her and landed squarely on the pole of the volleyball net. Kim had a swollen eye and a bad scrape on her thigh as a result of her tripping over her backpack as she attempted to kick me. There was no heartfelt peacemaking, no official détente. Once the teachers separated us, Kim and I looked at each other and started laughing. After finagling ourselves out of a visit to the principal's office, we limped home. Kim told me that the only reason that she volunteered for team captain was that if you did that at the beginning of a school year, coaches tended to remember, and that actually kept them from picking you in the future, a handy trick I co-opted from then on. I explained to her that I actually agreed with her take on To Kill a Mockingbird, which was one of my favorite books. And then that was it. We were friends, just as everyone had assumed all along that we would be. We never laid a hand on each other again, and even though we'd get into plenty of verbal clashes, our tiffs tended to end the way our fist fight had, with us cracking up. After our big brawl, though, Mrs. Shine refused to let Kim come over to my house, convinced that her daughter would return on crutches. Mom offered to go over and smooth things out, but I think that Dad and I both realized that given her temper, her diplomatic mission might end up with a restraining order against our family. In the end, Dad invited the Shines over for a roast chicken dinner, and though you could see Mrs. Shine was still a little weirded out by my family, "So you work in a record store while you study to become a teacher, and you do the cooking? How unusual," she said to Dad. Mr. Shine declared my parents decent and our family nonviolent and told Kim's mother that Kim ought to be allowed to come and go freely. For those few months in sixth grade, Kim and I shed our good girl personas. Talk about our fight circulated, the details growing more exaggerated. Broken ribs, torn off fingernails, bite marks. But when we came back to school after winter break, it was all forgotten. We were back to being the dark, quiet, good girl twins. We didn't mind anymore. In fact, over the years, that reputation has served us well. If, for instance, we were both absent on the same day, people automatically assumed we had come down with the same bug. Not that we ditched school to watch art films being shown in the film survey class at the university. When, as a prank, someone put our school up for sale, covering it with signs and posting a listing on eBay, suspicious eyes turned to Nelson Baker and Jenna McLaughlin, not to us. Even if we had owned up to the prank, as we'd planned to do if anyone else got in trouble, we'd have had a hard time convincing anyone it really was us. This always made Kim laugh. "People believe what they want to believe," she said. 4:47 p.m. Mom once snuck me into a casino. We were going on vacation to Crater Lake, and we stopped at a resort on an Indian reservation for the buffet lunch. Mom decided to do a bit of gambling, and I went with her while Dad stayed with Teddy, who was napping in his stroller. Mom sat down at the dollar blackjack tables.
The dealer looked at me, then at Mom, who returned his mildly suspicious glance with a look sharp enough to cut diamonds, followed by a smile more brilliant than any gem. The dealer sheepishly smiled back and didn't say a word. I watched Mom play, mesmerized. It seemed like we were in there for 15 minutes, but then Dad and Teddy came in search of us, both of them grumpy. It turned out we'd been there for over an hour. The ICU is like that. You can't tell what time of day it is or how much time has passed. There's no natural light. And there's a constant soundtrack of noise, only instead of the electronic beeping of slot machines and the satisfying jangle of quarters, it's the hum and whir of all the medical equipment, the endless muffled pages over the PA, and the steady talk of the nurses. I'm not entirely sure how long I've been in here. A while ago, the nurse I liked, with the lilting accent, said she was going home. "I'll be back tomorrow, but I want to see you here, sweetheart," she said. I thought that was weird at first. Wouldn't she want me to be home, or moved to another part of the hospital? But then I realized that she meant she wanted to see me in this ward, as opposed to dead. The doctors keep coming around and pulling up my eyelids and waving around a flashlight. They are rough and hurried, like they don't consider eyelids worthy of gentleness. It makes you realize how little in life we touch one another's eyes. Maybe your parents will hold an eyelid up to get out a piece of dirt, or maybe your boyfriend will kiss your eyelids, light as a butterfly, just before you drift off to sleep. But eyelids are not like elbows or knees or shoulders, parts of the body accustomed to being jostled. The social worker is at my bedside now. She is looking through my chart and talking to one of the nurses who normally sits at the big desk in the middle of the room. It is amazing the ways they watch you here. If they're not waving pen lights in your eyes or reading the printouts that come tumbling out from the bedside printers, then they are watching your vitals from a central computer screen. If anything goes slightly amiss, one of the monitors starts bleeping. There is always an alarm going off somewhere. At first, it scared me, but now I realize that half the time, when the alarm goes off, it's the machines that are malfunctioning, not the people. The social worker looks exhausted, as if she wouldn't mind crawling into one of the open beds. I am not her only sick person. She has been shuttling back and forth between patients and families all afternoon. She's the bridge between the doctors and the people, and you can see the strain of balancing between those two worlds. After she reads my chart and talks to the nurses, she goes back downstairs to my family, who have stopped talking in hushed tones and are now all engaged in solitary activities. Gran is knitting. Gramps is pretending to nab. Aunt Diane playing Sudoku. My cousins are taking turns on a Game Boy, the sound turned to mute. Kim has left. When she came back to the waiting room after visiting the chapel, she found Mrs. Shine a total wreck. She seemed so embarrassed, and she hustled her mother out. Actually, I think having Mrs. Shine there probably helped. Comforting her gave everyone else something to do, a way to feel useful. Now they're back to feeling useless. Back to the endless wait. When the social worker walks into the waiting room, everyone stands up, like they're greeting royalty. She gives a half-smile, which I've seen her do several times already today. I think it's her signal that everything is okay, or status quo, and she's just here to deliver an update, not to drop a bomb. Mia is still unconscious, but her vital signs are improving, she tells the assembled relatives, who have abandoned their distractions haphazardly on the chairs. She's in with the respiratory therapists right now. They're running tests to see how her lungs are functioning and whether she can be weaned off the ventilator.
That's good news, then? Aunt Diane asks. I mean, if she can breathe on her own, then she'll wake up soon?
The social worker gives a practiced, sympathetic nod. It's a good step if she can breathe on her own. It shows her lungs are healing and her internal injuries are stabilizing. The question mark is still the brain contusions.
Why is that? Cousin Heather interrupts.
We don't know when she will wake up on her own or the extent of the damage to her brain. These first 24 hours are the most critical, and Mia is getting the best possible care.
Can we see her? Gramps asks. The social worker nods.
That's why I'm here. I think it would be good for Mia to have a short visit. Just one or two people.
We'll go, Gran says, stepping forward. Gramps is by her side.
Yes, that's what I thought, the social worker says.
We won't be long, she says to the rest of the family.
The three of them walk down the hall in silence. In the elevator, the social worker attempts to prepare my grandparents for the sight of me, explaining the extent of my external injuries, which look bad but are treatable.
It's the internal injuries that they're worried about, she says.
She's acting like my grandparents are children, but they're tougher than they look. Gramps was a medic in Korea, and Gran, she's always rescuing things. Birds with broken wings, a sick beaver, a deer hit by a car. The deer went to a wildlife sanctuary, which is funny because Gran usually hates deer. They eat up her garden.
Pretty rats, she calls them.
Tasty rats is what Gramps calls them when he grills up venison steaks. But that one deer, Gran couldn't bear to see it suffer, so she rescued it. Part of me suspects she thought it was one of her angels. Still, when they come through the automatic double doors into the ICU, both of them stop, as if repelled by an invisible barrier. Gran takes Gramps' hand, and I try to remember if I've ever seen them hold hands before. Gran scans the beds for me, but just as the social worker starts to point out where I am, Gramps sees me and he strides across the floor to my bed.
Hello, Duck, he says.
He hasn't called me that in ages, not since I was younger than Teddy. Gran walks slowly to where I am, taking little gulps of air as she comes. Maybe those wounded animals weren't such good prep after all. The social worker pulls over two chairs, setting them up at the foot of my bed.
Mia, your grandparents are here.
She motions for them to sit down.
I'll leave you alone now.
Can she hear us?
Gran asks.
If we talk to her, she'll understand?
Truly, I don't know, the social worker responds. But your presence can be soothing so long as what you say is soothing.
Then she gives them a stern look, as if to tell them not to say anything bad to upset me. I know it's her job to warn them about things like this, and that she is busy with a thousand things and can't always be so sensitive, but for a second, I hate her. After the social worker leaves, Gran and Gramps sit in silence for a minute. Then Gran starts prattling on about the orchids she's growing in her greenhouse. I notice that she's changed out of her gardening smock into a clean pair of corduroy pants and a sweater. Someone must have stopped by her house to bring her fresh clothes. Gramps is sitting very still, and his hands are shaking. He's not much of a talker, so it must be hard for him being ordered to chat with me now. Another nurse comes by. She has dark hair and dark eyes brightened with lots of shimmery eye makeup. Her nails are acrylic and have heart decals on them. She must have to work hard to keep her nails so pretty. I admire that. She's not my nurse, but she comes up to Gran and Gramps just the same.
Don't you doubt for a second that she can hear you, she tells them. She's aware of everything that's going on.
She stands there with her hands on her hips. I can almost picture her snapping gum. Gran and Gramps stare at her, lapping up what she's telling them.
You might think that the doctors or nurses or all this is running the show, she says, gesturing to the wall of medical equipment. Nuh-uh. She's running the show. Maybe she's just biding her time. So you talk to her. You tell her to take all the time she needs, but to come on back. You're waiting for her.
Mom and Dad would never call Teddy or me mistakes, or accidents, or surprises, or any of those other stupid euphemisms. But neither one of us was planned, and they never tried to hide that. Mom got pregnant with me when she was young. Not teenager young, but young for their set of friends. She was 23, and she and Dad had already been married for a year. In a funny way, Dad was always a bow tie wearer, always a little more traditional than you might imagine, because even though he had blue hair and tattoos and wore leather jackets and worked in a record store, he wanted to marry Mom back at a time when the rest of their friends were still having drunken one-night stands. Girlfriend is such a stupid word, he said. I couldn't stand calling her that.
So we had to get married, so I could call her wife.
Mom, for her part, had a messed up family. She didn't go into the gory details with me, but I knew her father was long gone, and for a while she had been out of touch with her mother. Though we now saw Grandma and Papa Richard, which is what we called Mom's stepfather, a couple times a year. So Mom was taken not just with Dad, but with the big, mostly intact, relatively normal family he belonged to. She agreed to marry Dad, even though they'd been together just a year. Of course, they still did it in their way. They were married by a lesbian justice of the peace while their friends played a guitar feedback heavy version of the wedding march. The bride wore a white fringed flapper dress and black spiked boots. The groom wore leather. They got pregnant with me because of someone else's wedding. One of Dad's music buddies who'd moved to Seattle had gotten his girlfriend pregnant, so they were doing the shotgun thing. Mom and Dad went to the wedding, and at the reception, they got a little drunk and back at the hotel weren't as careful as usual. 3 months later, there was a thin blue line on the pregnancy test. The way they tell it, neither felt particularly ready to be parents. Neither one felt like an adult yet, but there was no question that they would have me. Mom was adamantly pro-choice. She had a bumper sticker on the car that read, "If you can't trust me with a choice, how can you trust me with a child?" But in her case, the choice was to keep me. Dad was more hesitant, more freaked out, until the minute the doctor pulled me out, and then he started to cry. "That's poppycock," he would say when Mom recounted the story. "I did no such thing." "You didn't cry then?" Mom asked in sarcastic amusement. "I teared. I did not cry." Then Dad winked at me and pantomimed weeping like a baby. Because I was the only kid in Mom and Dad's group of friends, I was a novelty. I was raised by the music community, with dozens of aunties and uncles who took me in as their own little foundling, even after I started showing a strange preference for classical music. I didn't want for real family, either. Gran and Gramps lived nearby, and they were happy to take me for weekends so Mom and Dad could act wild and stay out all night for one of Dad's shows. Around the time I was 4, I think my parents realized that they were actually doing it, raising a kid, even though they didn't have a ton of money or real jobs. We had a nice house with cheap rent. I had clothes, even if they were hand-me-downs from my cousins, and I was growing up happy and healthy. "You were like an experiment," Dad said. "Surprisingly successful. We thought it must be a fluke. We needed another kid as a kind of control group." They tried for 4 years. Mom got pregnant twice and had 2 miscarriages. They were sad about it, but they didn't have the money to do all the fertility stuff that people do. By the time I was 9, they decided that maybe it was for the best. I was becoming independent. They stopped trying. As if to convince themselves how great it was not to be tied down by a baby, Mom and Dad bought us tickets to go visit New York for a week. It was supposed to be a musical pilgrimage. We would go to CBGB's and Carnegie Hall. But when, to her surprise, Mom discovered she was pregnant, and then, to her greater surprise, stayed pregnant past the first trimester, we had to cancel the trip. She was tired and sick to her stomach, and so grumpy Dad joked that she'd probably scare the New Yorkers. Besides, babies were expensive, and we needed to save. I didn't mind. I was excited about a baby. And I knew that Carnegie Hall wasn't going anywhere. I'd get there someday. 5:40 p.m. I'm a little freaked out right now. Gran and Gramps left a while ago, but I stayed behind here in the ICU. I am sitting in one of the chairs, going over their conversation, which was very nice and normal and non-disturbing, until they left. As Gran and Gramps walked out of the ICU, with me following, Gramps turned to Gran and asked, "Do you think she decides?" "Decides what?" Gramps looked uncomfortable. He shuffled his feet. "You know." "Decides," he whispered. "What are you talking about?" Gran sounded exasperated and tender at the same time. "I don't know what I'm talking about. You're the one who believes in all the angels."
What does that have to do with Mia?
Gran asked. If they're gone now, but still here, like you believe, what if they want her to join them? What if she wants to join them?
It doesn't work like that, Gran snapped.
Oh, was all Gramps said. The inquiry was over. After they left, I was thinking that one day maybe I'll tell Gram that I never much bought into her theory that birds and such could be people's guardian angels, and now I'm more sure than ever that there's no such thing. My parents aren't here. They are not holding my hand or cheering me on. I know them well enough to know that if they could, they would. Maybe not both of them. Maybe Mom would stay with Teddy while Dad watched over me. But neither of them is here. And it's while contemplating this that I think about what the nurse said. She's running the show. And suddenly I understand what Gramps was really asking, Gran. He had listened to that nurse, too. He got it before I did. If I stay. If I live. It's up to me. All this business about medically induced comas is just doctor talk. It's not up to the doctors. It's not up to the absentee angels. It's not even up to God, who, if he exists, is nowhere around right now. It's up to me. How am I supposed to decide this? How can I possibly stay without Mom and Dad? How can I leave without Teddy? Or Adam? This is too much. I don't even understand how it all works, why I'm here in the state that I'm in, or how to get out of it if I wanted to. If I were to say, I want to wake up, would I wake up right now? I already tried snapping my heels to find Teddy and trying to beam myself to Hawaii, and that didn't work. This seems a whole lot more complicated. But in spite of that, I believe it's true. I hear the nurse's words again. I am running the show. Everyone is waiting on me. I decide. I know this now. And this terrifies me more than anything else that has happened today. Where the hell is Adam?
A week before Halloween of my junior year, Adam showed up at my door triumphant. He was holding a dress bag and wearing a shit-eating grin. Prepare to writhe in jealousy. I just got the best costume, he said. He unzipped the bag. Inside was a frilly white shirt, a pair of breeches, and a long wool coat with epaulets. You're going to be Seinfeld with the puffy shirt? I asked.
Pfft, Seinfeld. And you call yourself a classical musician. I'm going to be Mozart. Wait, you haven't seen the shoes.
He reached into the bag and pulled out clunky black leather numbers with metal bars across the tops. Nice, I said. I think my mom has a pair like them.
You're just jealous because you don't have such a rockin' costume. And I'll be wearing tights, too. I'm just that secure in my manhood. Also, I have a wig.
Where'd you get all this? I asked, fingering the wig. It felt like it was made of burlap.
Online? Only $100.
You spent $100 on a Halloween costume? At the mention of the word Halloween, Teddy zoomed down the stairs, ignoring me and yanking on Adam's wallet chain.
Wait here,
he demanded, and then ran back upstairs and returned a few seconds later holding a bag.
Is this a good costume, or will it make me look babyish?
Teddy asked, pulling out a pitchfork, a set of devil ears, a red tail, and a pair of red feety pajamas.
Oh.
Adam stepped backward, his eyes wide. That outfit scares the hell out of me, and you aren't even wearing it.
Really? You don't think the pajamas make it look dumb? I don't want anyone to laugh at me,
Teddy declared, his eyebrows furrowed in seriousness. I grinned at Adam, who was trying to swallow his own smile. Red pajamas plus pitchfork plus devil ears and pointy tail is so fully satanic no one would dare challenge you, lest they risk eternal damnation, Adam assured him. Teddy's face broke into a wide grin, showing off the gap of his missing front tooth.
That's kind of what Mom said, but I just wanted to make sure she wasn't just telling me that so I wouldn't bug her about the costume. You're taking me trick-or-treating, right?
He looked at me now. Just like every year, I answered. How else am I going to get candy?
You're coming too?
He asked Adam.
I wouldn't miss it.
Teddy turned on his heel and whizzed back up the stairs. Adam turned to me.
That's Teddy settled. What are you wearing?
I'm not much of a costume girl.
Adam rolled his eyes. Well, become one. It's Halloween, our first one together. Shooting Star has a big show that night. It's a costume concert, and you promised to go.
Inwardly, I groaned. After 6 months with Adam, I had just gotten used to us being the odd couple at school. People called us Groovy and the Geek. And I was starting to become more comfortable with Adam's bandmates, and I had even learned a few words of rock talk. I could hold my own now when Adam took me to the House of Rock, the rambling house near the college where the rest of the band all lived. I could even participate in the band's punk rock potluck parties when everyone invited had to bring something from their fridge that was on the verge of spoiling. We took all the ingredients and made something out of it. I was actually pretty good at finding ways to turn the vegetarian ground beef, beets, feta cheese, and apricots into something edible. But I still hated the shows and hated myself for hating them. The clubs were smoky, which hurt my eyes and made my clothes stink. The speakers were always turned up so high that the music blared, causing my ears to ring so loudly afterward that the high-pitched drone would actually keep me up. I'd lie in bed replaying the awkward night and feeling shittier about it with each playback. "Don't tell me you're going to back out," Adam said, looking equal parts hurt and irritated.
"What about Teddy? We promised we'd take him trick-or-treating."
"Yeah, at 5 o'clock. We don't have to be at the show until 10. I doubt even Master Ted could trick-or-treat for 5 solid hours, so you have no excuse. And you'd better get a good outfit together, because I'm going to look hot, in an 18th-century kind of way." After Adam left to go to work delivering pizzas, I had a pit in my stomach. I went upstairs to practice the Dvorak piece Professor Christie had assigned me and to work out what was bothering me. Why didn't I like his shows? Was it because Shooting Star was getting popular and I was jealous? Did the ever-growing masses of girl groupies put me off? This seemed like a logical enough explanation, but it wasn't it. After I'd played for about 10 minutes, it came to me. My aversion to Adam's shows had nothing to do with music or groupies or envy. It had to do with the doubts. The same niggling doubts I always had about not belonging. I didn't feel like I belonged with my family, and now I didn't feel like I belonged with Adam. Except unlike my family, who was stuck with me, Adam had chosen me, and this I didn't understand. Why had he fallen for me? It didn't make sense. I knew it was music that brought us together in the first place, put us in the same space so we could even get to know each other, and I knew that Adam liked how into music I was, and that he dug my sense of humor, so dark you almost miss it, he said. And speaking of dark, I knew he had a thing for dark-haired girls because all of his girlfriends had been brunettes. And I knew that when it was the two of us alone together, we could talk for hours, or sit reading side by side for hours, each one plugged into our own iPod, and still feel completely together. I understood all that in my head, but I still didn't believe it in my heart. When I was with Adam, I felt picked, chosen, special. And that just made me wonder, why me even more? And maybe this was why, even though Adam willingly submitted to Schubert symphonies and attended any recital I gave, bringing me stargazer lilies, my favorite flower, I'd still rather have gone to the dentist than to one of his shows. Which was so churlish of me. I thought of what Mom sometimes said to me when I was feeling insecure. Fake it till you make it. By the time I finished playing the piece 3 times over, I decided that not only would I go to his show, but for once I'd make as much of an effort to understand his world as he did mine. "I need your help," I told Mom that night after dinner as we stood side by side doing dishes. "I think we've established that I'm not very good at trigonometry. Maybe you can try the online tutor thing," Mom said. "Not math help, something else." "I'll do my best. What do you need?" "Advice. Who's the coolest, toughest, hottest rocker girl you can think of?
Debbie Harry, Mom said.
That not finished, Mom interrupted. You can't ask me to pick only one. That's so Sophie's choice.